I'm pleased to introduce our next panel, and it's titled Moving Forward, Organizing and Mobilizing Around Differences and Shared Identities. And with that, what I will do is turn this over to Professor Vinit Parma. He is the Vice Chair of ARI's Board and an Assistant Professor in Film at Brooklyn College who will be moderating this panel. I turn it over to you, Vinit. Thank you.
Before I open up and introduce our panelists, our wonderful talent here, I just want to ask you, the audience, a quick, brief question. We define social media, apparently, now, as it's constantly changing, as folks that are active on Facebook, Twitter. Is this loud enough, by the way? Yeah, it's okay. Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, WeChat, and Instagram. Thank you. So those and others that I haven't mentioned. So I just was curious, how many of you are active in either or any of those? Wow, great. Fantastic. Thank you. So I'm pleased to introduce our first panelist, Anita Gundana. She's the Executive Director of the Coalition for Asian American Children and Families, the nation's only children and families policy advocacy organization representing the Pan-Asian community. She's also pursuing a doctorate at Columbia University School of Social Work, studying the role of pan-ethnic identity in organizational coalition building.
I guess we'll just jump in. I'm going to be attempting to set the stage a little bit with my talk around considerations in galvanizing the APA community, and I hope that what I can do is kind of set a stage that would lend itself to a talk around the use of media and social media. Specifically, what I'm discussing is the role of the Pan-Asian collective identity in itself in terms of coalition building, and I am proposing kind of a model or a framework or structure to think about how we can use better this APA identity in terms of our coalition building work. It's the topic of my dissertation, so just to be clear, I've been studying this for about 7 years, but hopefully wrapping up soon. And it's also a key point of interest for the Coalition for Asian American Children and Families, or CACF, which is, as Vinit said, a coalition organization that focuses on the APA community, children and families needs specifically. So we've heard today through many of the panels about how diverse and our APA community is and how this identity, this APA identity, has both its limitations and also has its strengths in terms of galvanizing the community, bringing the community together under its umbrella. The APA identity itself can be a resource and useful as a tool almost in galvanizing the community, but just like any collective identity, it requires a lot of work to be used properly. Pan-ethnicity or an identity that encompasses multiple ethnicities can easily be misused, and we've heard some instances and people relaying how we have heard our own APA community or APA identity be used in ways that continue to oppress our own community. I'm a little energized around this because I just came back from a conference, a progressive caucus conference in city council, where a progressive city council member stood up and boldly declared that all Asians are doing just great in school. And so just as an example of how this kind of collective identity that we have is very complicated and needs to be worked at in order to really represent the true needs of our community. And it can be used as a tool of continued oppression and or marginalization of our communities, just as it was this morning, as I heard. from a quote-unquote progressive city council member. So what I'd like to kind of talk about is this frame of work that I'll call identity work that needs to be done in order for our collective APA community to move forward. And identity work in literature on social movements generally refers to the work that's done to align personal identities with a collective. So it's really a practical concept. It's useful to think of in terms of day-to-day coalition building. So it speaks to the idea that, you know, in order for people to come together, in order for people to participate, in order for people to mobilize, in order to coalition build, people need to be connected to, accurately represented by, and motivated by a larger identity, a larger collective. And that larger collective identity needs to become of primary importance to them. So identity work is actually really hard work. It's something that can't be summed up in a talk, but a framework that I'll try and set. We also, notably, live in a field of the identities, APA not being the only identity, obviously, that we all hold and share. So we have to think about the intersections of our identities as well, and how can we promote the salience of our APA identity. So recent data should suggest the National Asian American Survey actually just came out. It was done in 2016, a survey that showed that most people, Asian Americans included, are not clear about who falls under the Asian American category. So there is confusion, and it seems like we have a lot of work to do in promoting understanding and really creating a truly inclusive APA community. So using literature and combined with some of my field research, this model that I talk about in terms of identity work is by no means the be-all, end-all, but it's a starting point to discuss this framework that we can hopefully find helpful in moving forward. So there's three components to identity work that I'll identify. And one of them is called identity activation. So activation is the work we must do to prompt or motivate an APA identity. It's to bring it to the forefront, to give it relevance. In fact, being a part of a coalition itself can be activating. So not everybody who joins into a coalition or into a movement is activated in that identity or in that collective, to the same extent as everybody else, that actually a coalition and movement does the work of activating people as well. So, for example, people have called this work base building, or call this work base building, or movement building. This is the work of activating people into collective. For years, has been working on a group called the Students Advocacy Project, or ASAP, where we train high school youth to be policy advocates, to be leaders in their community. So that kind of work starts early with youth, and it really works to, or it's it works to kind of motivate APA students to learn and engage with the APA community, and also to stay involved in the APA community moving forward. We've heard in previous panels about community building efforts as part of activating our community, bringing community into the fold. Because so much of what we fight is trying to exclude the APA community, the activation of our community is so important. The second component that I'd like to address is this component called identity deployment. So this is the actual utilization of an identity, right? So we're talking about ways that we can use the identity through coalition building. For example, we can use an APA identity when we educate mainstream communities about the realities of what our community face. CACF, as an example, partners with a lot of other organizations to do advocacy with government officials, electeds, others in power. So, and using any type of city and state data that there is, which there is very little of at this moment, and also calling on better data to collect the needs of the APA community, because there lies power in numbers. So there is this deployment of an identity. We've also heard previous panelists talk about that a large part of deployment is about recognizing and building allies, working across various communities of color and other with other communities. It's about stepping up, about being present, about representing. So there's this concept of deployment. And there's so many examples of how these concepts can be, you know, in play as we coalition build. The third component of identity work, and the third and final component of this very simple kind of framework, is, I think, one of the most important and also one of the most overlooked components in kind of moving and galvanizing an APA community. And it's so critical. And it's actually the deconstruction of identity. So identity deconstruction. This concept comes out of the LGBTQ movement, and it's really kind of key, deconstruction from within. What this means is, as part of coalition building, we always have to be questioning the sweeping and broad identities that we discuss and that we use. So many that have been placed onto us or on top of us. So we need to be constantly questioning, doing the work to disaggregate specific community needs within the diverse APA community before jumping in to aggregate the APA community. So it's about doing the work to listen to the many or the multiple voices before jumping to assume a pan-ethnic identity. So this kind of disaggregation or deconstruction from within is really key to maintaining the relevance of an APA movement or moving forward under, you know, and coalition building under an APA umbrella. This deconstruction is also extremely critical and more important to ensure that we don't do the work to perpetuate systems of oppression that many of our communities face. It's way too easy to kind of jump into a pan-ethnic identity without truly understanding what is the diversity within. So, you know, again, there's so many examples of what deconstruction could look like. At CACF, we fight for data disaggregation. And, you know, that's only one way of kind of parsing out what's really going on in our communities. But it's not just data. It's the work, like I'd mentioned, of listening, respecting differing viewpoints. And we just heard in the last panel about the difficulties of this, that identity work in and of itself is not an easy task at hand. And, you know, we heard in the last panel about ideas of compassion and curiosity, and about respecting differing viewpoints and differences of deconstruction from within. And only when that work is done can we possibly try and galvanize an APA movement moving forward. And I liken this to this idea of almost like a muscle. In order to build a muscle, we need to tear it down. Not a be-all, end-all, but just kind of an easier framework to look at this this kind of picture of identity work, activation, deployment, and deconstruction, all of which kind of subsume, if we're going to move forward as an, you know, as an APA community or galvanize the community forward, you know, all of components, I think, can be moved forward through the use of media and social media in very interesting and crucial ways, especially as social media opens up new ways of dialogue, new ways of communication, new ways of listening, talking, and really kind of exploring these ideas of how we can activate and how we can deploy and how we can also work to deconstruct our kind of broad sweeping identities that we use.
Well, thank you so much, Anita. Certainly something, a lot to think about in terms of the three methods, because what I sense from this is that social media can be used in those three ways. I'm not sure if we think of social media in those three ways. I wanted to ask our panelists to look into that as they have their they're going to be talking about their work. But certainly, our council member this morning needed to be deconstructed in his concept of what he thought, you know, Asian Americans are. Are we all, you know, getting 95s on that exam? So, pleased to announce now Rachel Kuo, and she's a doctoral student at NYU in the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication. And she's studying digital media organizing and racial justice activism.
So today what I'm going to do is just offer some short reflections on the possibilities and limits of social media. They're kind of like thought wisps and fragments, since there's a lot to talk about and discuss. And I'll focus mostly on Twitter and hashtags as activist tools, particularly in relation to their capacity to sustain and build networks and communities, and also in their ability to cultivate solidarity. So hashtags can operate as part of a social movement toolkit to collectively disseminate information, discuss different needs, and also make demands. Also, hashtags have, like, personally, like, been a way for me to find community and also, like, find ways that I'm challenging my own thinking. They're a specific tool where they can be used at specific moments that can extend and expand existing movements and discourses, particularly when focusing on forging the bonds of solidarity and addressing intersectionality, engagement, and community. Participants connect their own experiences, identities, and perspectives to the hashtag, which then, like, archives and links together discourses part of this intertextual chain that represents a heterogeneous community of many voices. And so as this device, the unity and specificity of hashtags also combined with the individual ways that participants can express their many identities and histories to the digital public can also connect together the really complicated and messy social conditions of racial injustice and disrupt dominant ideologies. And so to give a few well-known examples from a relatively recent history of activist hashtags, like, we have Mikki Kendall's Solidarity is for White Women as a way to disrupt embedded white feminist logics that exclude women of color. I Am Not Your Wedge as a way to disrupt the ways that Asian Americans have been used as a tool for oppression and to facilitate white supremacy. So a lot of these racial justice activist hashtags, as they get used over and over again, they're able to index to counter ideological discourse about whose bodies and whose rights are valued. So, however, we also know the limits of what it means to unite solely around one's specific racial, ethnic, or national identity. So, for example, in November 2014, after a Kai Gurley was shot and killed by Peter Liang, the campaign's Model Minority Mutiny and Asians for Black Lives were strong examples that were able to unite us through reciprocal solidarity practices with each other as well as with other communities of color. So many grassroots grassroots organizing from different Asian American groups from across the country, including some who are represented here today from amazing leaders that talked about their work, including Seeding Change, the Southeast Freedom Network, CAV, Drum, SALT, NAPWAF, 18 Million Rising, and many more, like, did a lot of work also to use these hashtags to move these calls for solidarity to offline on the ground actions. And so the hashtags were able to make their way also from this digital realm into the streets as people were writing it on their protest signs, right? And so, in addition to Twitter, we can think about how these hashtags get used in online solidarity statements as well. So, CAV has written one. There was also one written by a collective of South Asian organizations, including the National Queer Asian Pacific Islander Alliance, Muslim American Women's Policy Forum, and the Bay Area Solidarity Group, which created like a solidarity statement under the hashtag South Asians for Black Power and Justice for Muslims. So, in the ways that these circulate through these circulated statements, like, the organizations can make a direct connection between the violence against Black bodies and also violence against members of the Asian American community in a way to unite the liberation of these communities as a mutually interdependent struggle. So, kind of like drawing on older forms of media that can now be digitized and circulated in different ways, the combination of the hashtag and solidarity statements are able to reflect the diverse dynamics and relationships within a community and also remind communities to commit to being more accountable to the ways, to all of their members in order to foster a movement and strive for liberation that centers the members of the communities that are most excluded and least visible or most marginalized under the logics of settler colonialism and white supremacy. Christina Shi, who many of you know started Letters for Black Lives, has spoken about the need to practice more flexibility and agility in our political responses, which becomes difficult to do if we're building movements out of attachments to rigid formations of identity. So like maybe like some movements that I think have done a really good job of troubling that, for example, has been like Idle No More, which has been a global indigenous like anti-settler colonialism, decolonization, and environmental justice movement. There's also like now a lot of like the kink sanctuary movements that may offer a way to think how we might redefine and rethink identity and community in more capacious and imaginative ways while still centering the needs of those who are most vulnerable. I also think part of this flexibility and agility means thinking about the ethics of how we practice non-judgmental listening online and reflexivity in the ways that we learn, act, and grow, and enable and support others through the same. An example of this that I've been thinking about was Not Your Mule, which was also started by Mickey Kendall after the 2016 Oscars to call in non-Black people of color for expecting Black activists to lay the groundwork for social change, and she was talking about the hashtag as a way to reject the expectations of Black people to bear the burden and risk for all. And then so as a way to hold Kendall's critique and also take it up as a call to do more collaborative work, Jaya Sundaresh started hashtag only 1%, which was about Asian American representation in media, which unfortunately got re-co-opted as a way to shift that blame of like invisible representation back on to the Black community as if a way like the visibility of Black people in the media was responsible for the exclusion of Asian people. So Sundaresh like wrote a response to circulate to kind of address the anti-Blackness that is rampant in a lot of discourses of like media representation. And so I think like this as like a kind of example or case exemplifies what Candace Chia describes as collaborative antagonisms or collaborative in the sense of working together but also working subversively against power and also antagonistic in the ways that different approaches to knowledge are able to critique and identify each other's limits. Other things that I've been recently thinking about is the potential possibilities for prioritizing an ethic of social redistribution through digital media activism, whether that's creating new media spaces, flows of knowledge, and directions of feelings. Who do we cite? Who do we talk to? Or whose anger, happiness, and sadness do we actually care for online and offline? So to cite bell hooks here, solidarity is not the same as support. To experience solidarity, we must have a community of interest, shared beliefs, and goals around which to unite. Sustained support cannot be based on self-interest, such as guilt or merely wanting to feel good about helping. From this understanding, we know that Twitter hashtags alone then do not form solidarity and cannot be the only expression of that, right? So if we think about hashtags as being meaningful and powerful because of the ways that networked clusters of people can respond and mobilize and amplify, I think it's also useful to think about the roles that we play as being part of a network with many intersecting lines and nodes at different points of connection. In this vein, we can also begin thinking about how media activism takes different forms and occurs on various scales. It can range from direct actions to put pressure on media institutions to change government policies or around the material labor of like writing articles and transforming narratives or even just the quick one-button act of retweeting to circulate a message to different networks. So sustaining online movements requires attentions to both the bursts and streams of content and the different time and access across the different times and access and capacities of users. So if solidarity is built upon an ongoing and consistent commitment, another point of consideration here may be around like issues of time, right? Like different social media platforms are in different temporal rhythms and also have different attention economies. So because of this, a pitfall also becomes like a repeated loop of information that recirculates at different moments, which then also, though, can become an opportunity to engage new people through an abundance of rich and deep conversations, and also for those who have been more continuously engaged to take up a bigger challenge beyond not just shifting from online to offline, but also shifting from discourse to action. So beyond gaining the tools to be able to talk about social injustice is really to think about how we engage with these ideas as part of our everyday lives. Practice. So while hashtags can function as gestures of solidarity, they are also just a limited or small piece of the movement. They must be used alongside a variety of tools as well as on-the-ground action So we should also like think about how we take up the challenge of addressing colonial and racist systems of oppression in everyday life beyond the hashtag and also beyond activist movements. So there's a lot of uneasy and messy work to be done. Solidarity is not meant to be an easy thing. So how do we really think about maintaining partnerships that are truly fluid, reciprocal, critical, and intersectional that can address multiple perspectives and issues? How do we think about how we fight for justice outside the bounds of being merely included in a capital in the nation state? So those are like really big stakes for like why this online activism is important and these conversations are important. And then the last thing that I kind of want to end on is we also should remember that social media is not always equalizing or democratizing. While the strategic use of different platforms allows us to make interventions on social, cultural, and political structures, uneven power relations are also embedded into the technologies themselves in terms of infrastructure, access, and labor. So, for example, the condition of our possibility to actually even use some of these platforms is made possible through the corporate exploitation of people and places in East, South, and Southeast Asia, the Pacific Islanders, like geographic regions that we feel really connected to as well. So I do want to end with this quote by Alicia Garza, one of the women who started Black Lives Matter. So when Black people get free, everyone gets free. Black Lives Matter doesn't mean your life isn't important. It means that Black lives, which are seen as without value within white supremacy, are important to your liberation. To keep it real, it is appropriate and necessary to have strategy and action centered on Blackness without other non-Black communities of color or white folks, for that matter, needing to find a place and a way to center themselves within it. And so from Garza's statement, I like would also add that as a provocation to re-envision our place and our contributions, whether on or offline in social justice movements, and how we're open to rejecting the settler state as our site of liberation while also centering Black and Indigenous liberation and futurity.
And it's really valuable to think about, of course, the strengths of social media and also its limits, because, you know, Twitter with 140, there's so much you can do and there's so much you cannot do. And certainly it can start movements, but then where do we go from there? So later on we'll be talking about on the ground action. But social media can, you know, and this is the reason why I asked folks to raise their hand to try to figure out who is on social media, because there are folks that are not. And that's part of the challenge, is to how do we get folks that are not necessarily on these modes of communication, and to identify them and to activate them and to go through that activation and deployment and deconstruction process. So with that in mind, I want to introduce you to James Hong. He's the co-director at the Min Kwan Center for Community Action in Flushing, New York.
The Min Kwan Center, we have been around since 1984. We have been working a lot in the Korean-American community, but also more recently a lot in the Asian-American community and the immigrant community. We do this through a few different program areas. We do advocacy and organizing. We do voter engagement, a youth program. And we also have a pretty robust social and legal services program. So we have four lawyers on staff working in the fields of immigration, housing, and labor. And we also help people get access to specific benefits such as food stamps, heating assistance, and we run a very big tax clinic every year. Most of our staff are bilingual, neither Korean or Mandarin, and we do our work with the focus of helping those who are limited English proficient, low income, or undocumented, or some combination of those. That's where we put our focus, although our doors are open to everyone. So I just want to, you know, start with, you know, thanking Ari and the organizers of this great conference. And to recognize a lot of the knowledge that's in this room. Mitch asked me to be on this panel, and I kind of said, I don't know if I should be speaking on social media. It seems like the people on this panel have so much knowledge regarding that, and I'm sure in the audience as well. So just want to recognize that. I'll talk a little bit about, Min Kwan's activity in the Asian American community and in social media.
We started our collaboration in the redistricting work that happened back in 2011, and this sort of evolved into you know, working on voter engagement together as well. So we do things like door knocking, phone banking, creating literature, you know, holding candidate forums. These are like sort of the bread and butter of, you know, civic engagement in any community, but then we are doing it specifically in the Asian American community. Last year, in the presidential primaries, we were able to increase voter turnout among the people that we targeted, the Asian Americans that we targeted, between 1.5 and 5%, depending on what part of the city you were looking at. So overall, we were able to boost the turnout by 1.5%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I've heard that this is actually quite an achievement. But with regards to technology and social media, which, you know, we're talking about right now, we are definitely in an age that is being transformed by technology. The digital revolution, and with it the adoption of social media as a means of communication and relating to each other, are without a doubt powerful forces. We've seen this in, you know, we see this every day. Some things that came to mind was, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and the accountability that we're seeing for police brutality.
Another instance already mentioned today was the, you know, the Peter Liang case and the great groundswell of support in the Asian American community that came around one perspective in that situation. And of course, the rise of Donald Trump and his use of Twitter as his pulpit is a very salient example of how social media is being used today. For the community and for Asian Americans, I think social media does present us with a great opportunity to express solidarity among our different communities and together. So Facebook and Twitter, of course, do work well in that regard. And I think this solidarity is essential to, you know, our community's resistance to the forces of race-based oppression and discrimination that were legitimized to a large degree by what happened last November. However, the growth of the Asian American population is fueled strongly by immigration. So that means that home country identification will continue to remain quite strong, I believe. You know, like those people from, you know, a country, when they immigrate here, they don't think of themselves as Asians or Asian Americans. They think of themselves primarily along the lines of nationality or ethnicity. So a pan-Asian consciousness is not how those new immigrants think. So in going forward, I think we, as scholars or activists, we do have to adjust our approaches to both sort of the second generation or Asian American or American-born Asian Americans and those who are newer immigrants. At Mingquan Center, we deal with this every day. I feel like whenever we're kind of embarking on a campaign and a strategy, whether it's, you know, driver's licenses for all in New York or, you know, districting or rezoning that's affecting Flushing, I think, you know, there's always like kind of almost two audiences that we're trying to get into the fight. It is like the first generation immigrant folks as well as the more second generation people. And, you know, Asian American groups like us, CACF and many others in this room, I think we expend significant capacity in constant translation and dual strategies when we're trying to engage our community fully. Because as great as it is to, you know, engage each other in English on Facebook and Twitter, like so much of our community is still first generation and interacting with each other outside of that. Now, Regarding that, platforms such as WeChat and KakaoTalk in the Chinese and Korean American communities, I feel like they respectively deserve their own mini strategy, given their high penetration into almost all segments of these communities. I'm not that familiar with, you know, what's, if there's other platforms in the other ethnic communities, but those I'm very familiar with, or familiar with. You know, this isn't like Facebook, but these chat or group chat apps, they have clearly been used for organizing, and more effectively, it seems, by conservatives, rather than progressives. I remember going home, right before, I think I was visiting, you know, my parents before, the election. My mom complained about how she kept getting these text messages or these KakaoTalk messages from a church member, and it was all like pro-Trump stuff. And she was just like, God, I get these every day. And I was like, wow, somebody's organizing in our church, unfortunately. So, organizing is good. But to me, it was a great example of what's happening in the first generation, community. What Minkwon has done in terms of media, I'd say we have paid attention to Facebook and Twitter. We have been using those platforms, but we haven't, to be honest, invested as heavily as we could have in the past, in the past years. Sometimes that we have used it is, for example, we led a campaign around the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act a few years ago. 2015 was the, 50th anniversary of that act, and we used the hashtag, restore the VRA. We had a campaign of people holding, the personalized messages, that I think a lot of campaigns use, where people write their personalized message and then take a picture and put it up there. So that was actually, fairly successful. I think we got something like, 17,000 retweets or like sort of the hashtag picked up 17,000 within a matter of a couple days. I would say in a large part we have used it, but more to just highlight really the other work that we're doing, which is on the ground, which is at the doors, or on the phones, or in person. For Minkwon Center, one of the reasons that we aren't doing that as much, is that our target population as an organization are the limited English proficient or low income, folks. So, seniors are a big part of the population that we work with. And Asian American seniors, they are a growing part of New York City and of our communities. And they are more likely to be limited English proficient, and they're more likely to be low income. A lot of the seniors that we engage with on a daily basis at Minkwon, they don't even have smartphones. These factors plus seniors' hesitance to use technology means they are still getting information from like just their social networks, from newspapers, radio, and television. So we are engaging those traditional outlets constantly as well. So I would say this is certainly an important way for our community to move forward and to resist. But we will have to continue to engage all parts of our community in different ways.
Yeah, we can certainly see this discussion can't be fit into just an hour and a half. We have so many complex issues because our APA community is so complex. And each certainly needs to be targeted and thought out well to bring out the groups that that are either isolated or not included or are using a different pathway. So certainly a lot of work to do here, but lots of great things to think about. Here, it's a great segue now to think about how it has been effective on the ground. So Pleased to introduce to you Samantha Ng. She's a rising third-year undergraduate student at Binghamton University, and she's double majoring in human development and Asian American studies. Good luck. Her experiences within coalition building and being present in activism spaces started when she was a youth advocate with the Coalition of Asian American Children and Families Youth Leadership Program, the Asian American Student Advocacy Project, ASAP, in high school. So since ASAP, she has devoted herself to engaging students in the electoral process in her college community and other AAPI spaces.
So digital media platforms, and they provide really excellent descriptions of the different frameworks and theoretical practices of digital media, for example, and like hashtags, for example, and also just different lenses that we can look at activism in the digital media age that we live in. And as we talked about just briefly, I'm just going to probably provide some of my experiences of how myself as an activist and also a student leader on my university campus, how social media kind of fits in our strategies, and just trying to look at how far we've come from, for example, 1968 SFSU, and also how student activists and student leaders have changed over time, and have we improved, answering questions of how have we improved, and where do we go from here?
Talking about how some of the tools and frameworks that we've been talking about are practiced on a college campus, for example, and what does it look like for younger folks to be living in the digital age today. How do we use this tool, social media and digital media, to stay connected, up to date with one another, and also build allyship with one another, so not just within the AAPI or APA community, but also with other ethnic communities and other communities of color on college campuses, because on my college campus, for example, the Black community, the Latinx community faces very different adversities and problems, for example, than what APA folks deal with on my college campus. From that, on my college campus, we don't always have the best or strongest organizational support or the administration's support. So just looking at how activists and student organizations kind of sustain their activism and also sustain what they're trying to fight for on a college campus, whether it's very minute things or very systemic and like broader system involved related issues. And also, how does social media activate us even when we don't want to? So at the beginning of the panel, we talked about how we're involved and how we're connected through digital media, and just looking at how even if we are on these platforms, how do Facebook, for example, or Twitter make us actively engage in political discourse or social justice issues? Like, how do hashtags, for example, play into our everyday lives? How often do we use it? How strategies by which they help us in our activism or just day-to-day activities as well. And what are our strides in creating those spaces? So Rachel briefly mentioned how 18 Million Rising has been talked about in a previous panel, and also many of us may or may not know that, but we should also look at how Angry Asian Man, for example, another activist or icon in the digital media age right now, talks about social justice issues and also bridging those issues with APA folks like myself or young APA folks, and also Reappropriate and just many others, and how they bridge social justice issues with us even if we don't want to be included in those conversations, and showing the necessity of us being in those conversations and, you know, being at the table as well.
So I wanted to start the conversation by first talking about the nature of social media. For example, James mentioned President Trump tweeting at 4 a.m. in the morning. So, and how that has created a movement. And of course, the challenge of that is for us in creating a positive movement for us is to coalesce here when that is a monologue, essentially. It can cut both ways. It can build silo, but it can also, therefore, antagonize.
And then think about creating that coalition building, which is part two of that. So, Rachel, if I may ask you to speak with your expertise in Twitter on how social media can be used in both ways.
Sure. I think the piece where you mentioned the monologues and the silent way, that's been a huge issue to kind of think about, especially on Twitter, of how do people actually speak to each other? Especially if we think about, while we're part of a network, not all networks are connected together. So someone can be very participatory and active in one way, but have no idea what's going on in another network, depending on, who else is on the feed, who they're speaking to, etc. So I think kind of thinking about how do we bring the folks that need to be brought in, I think also thinking about the ways that people locate their community or their spaces on social media, often then there's also something else that happens, potentially offline that draws someone to that space, right? I think I joined Twitter and started following specifically other Asian American writers, because I was really craving that in this kind of other media space. So I think it's kind of what in drawing people to those spaces, what conversations do they join? And then I think having been on Twitter now for a while, the kind of dedicated effort it takes to kind of start adding things to maybe that I might not necessarily love reading. Even thinking about adding Fox News and things like that to the, just to see what else is going on out there, to kind of try to figure out what are the other discourses to kind of pop out of the filter bubble. So that's kind of what I'm starting to think about.
In thinking about social media and organizing, I feel like it's also important to think about lessons learned from in-person organizing that we can translate then to social media.
So, a lot of weight is placed on constant contact and communication, and engaging with a base. And so I feel like in terms of translating that to the world of social media, I think in order to activate people or bring people into the fold, and we've had some success in this in other organizing efforts, and also trying to employ this at CACF right now, is just constantly updating things like Facebook feeds and feeding the community information and keeping that on the top of somebody's Facebook page. I don't know the technical terms of this, but in Facebook land, you can kind of disappear into the mist of feeds as other things. So I've actually seen tactics for example, if you want to have something disappear, that people post on groups. To, for example, if there was some sort of a negative comment or something that wasn't so helpful in drawing or wasn't helpful in a progressive conversation, specifically with Facebook, that people would post on top of that so that it would then disappear down into the feed. But similarly, on the positive side, if you want to gain some attraction to something or bring people into the fold, you would be constantly posting about that particular issue or articles related to or linking different conversations and bringing that to the forefront. So there's this kind of idea of using Facebook that I've seen to be in constant contact, or also to kind of on the negative side, to kind of distance from conversations that may not be so productive on feeds.
Thank you. So with that, then the question becomes for me is, first you look at when you're getting all these feeds and all these text messages, you're kind of inundated. You say, I've heard this before, and what do we do from here? How do we go forward? How do we move it forward? How does a simple hashtag lead to on-the-ground action when people show up? Of course, when you have a Peter the Angus type of situation, that's easy, because people just coalesce. 10,000 folks appeared that day. voicing protests. So, but hopefully we don't need a type of emergency situation for that to happen for an effective response, a more deeper response. And so my question to my panelists is how, for example, Samantha, have you seen a type of engagement that actually leads to change in on the ground work?
So, Johnson City and also Endicott, and they actually proposed a $1 million budget to create a blue light system on the west side of our Binghamton area. So the west side, if folks don't know, is an area where there are a lot of low-income residents. So we can call them like townies, for example, but residents of the Binghamton area where students usually live because the housing downtown is much cheaper. And this blue light system is essentially used as for people without cell phones, for example, to they would click the button on the blue light, and they would immediately contact police. And these blue light posts also have camera surveillance, so in immediate situations of conflict or anything, or if residents are actually like attacking university students, university students have this tool to contact the police or contact university police as well. And so this system has been used in multiple universities across the country, many universities across the country, and the system has helped and also hindered students and also the local community. And this actually became a very large social justice issue for the residents in the Binghamton area, because not only are the residents in the area low income, but they're also predominantly Black and also African American, Latinx as well. And so residents, Binghamton University residents that live in this area can see the residents in the area as threats to them, and that's deeply, deeply problematic. I don't want to go into that right now, but what university students have been doing is actually, they've been actually organizing with a single hashtag, which is No Blue Lights, I believe, and No Blue Lights We You. And from this hashtag alone, they've been able to stage a 7-day sit-in at our administration building on campus, and they've gotten a lot of media attention. They've gotten the attraction of our university administration, and also they've gotten the support of faculty, staff, professors, and student organizations on campus to express solidarity for them and have the university reconsider the $1 million to be used for other uses on campus, for example, so for like mental health resources on campus, facility reconstructions, and things like that as well. And so through the hashtag, for example, through the sit-in, and through just the reach that we as university students have, and just getting the word out there, I feel like that's one really great example of how young folks like myself and on a college campus have been able to mobilize and do something this extraordinary. And we've made strides in that sense, but university has moved on to probably carry out the blue light system, and it's kind of unfortunate that students weren't participatory in the conversation that they've been having, but the fact that the local news outlets have been covering it, and also we've been trending in all that sense on the East Coast, it's been pretty extraordinary.
Great. Great to hear. Thank you for all that work. Being part of that is very important, because what happens in the micro, as we know, reflects the macro. And so here, part of this hashtag that does go out to students and to a certain group of folks certainly ends up affecting that group. But my question is then, can social media be effective in mixing or having an inter-ethnic dialogue, or at least connecting different groups? Because then that can overcome the problem of monologue or silo effect. James, have you had a chance in your work to do that? I know that you don't do so much social media activism, but
I think Yeah, like the example I mentioned before, it was it was a pan-Asian effort within the AP Voice coalition, but also beyond that, actually. So we had all types of organizations and individuals participating in the Voting Rights Act campaign. I think, like, campaigns like that are on Twitter, I think, largely they're like English speakers. They are people who are most comfortable in English. So I think to engage that part of our community that is, their primary language is not English, you have to take a little bit of a different tack, and you have to, use a different, maybe it's a different platform or some other methods.
Curated, monitored, and moderated. Without that fine hand at the wheel, it becomes very. You're going to lose your audience and lose the momentum, right?
And I would say, one example, that made this clear to me was that, our coalition, we put on a training in the aftermath of some of the. The election and then these executive orders and such. So, from the president, and we put together bystander intervention training several months ago, and we put this on with the idea that people in our communities are being affected. From our member organizations, there are South Asian organizations that work with a lot of Muslim Americans. So we put this on with the thought that, our community could show up, and we have a translation, all prepared. We have many languages, all these, interpretation, the equipment ready. But it was very mixed, and then a lot of, white, people who were concerned. We ended up not using the interpretation equipment. And I think it's part of the success of social media, things like this, is the right time, at the right moment, people are interested in a thing and then they just show up. I think part of it is just timing and doing something at the right time. The New York Immigration Coalition, who organized the protests at JFK, and then another protest a few days afterwards. They had no idea about the size of the crowds that would be coming out. So they were planning, for just maybe a couple thousand down in Battery Park City, and they had a crowd of 20,000. So it was an unprecedented amount of turnout for that kind of action. And I think part of it was just. People out there, the people that you're not even targeting, that they were looking for something to react to. So part of it was their ability to be out on social media at the right time.
Actually, I mean, I'm not any expert on social media. I had a question that maybe the panelists can also address, or maybe people in the audience too. In organizing spaces, we talk about this idea of trying to form safe spaces and encouraging dialogue and things of that nature. And I think that the world, and I was speaking with somebody during lunch about this, is the world of internet kind of changes that idea of safe spaces. And especially if we're talking about current administration and the ability of people to speak and speak through all of these various modalities that they may not feel comfortable to do so, and rightly so. They might be monitored by people who they're who they don't know there's no way to erase the internet, right? So whatever is said stays. So these ideas, I think, these different tools in the internet change this idea of, and of how we can really activate and engage. So I was wondering if there was.
This past February, I attended the East Coast Asian American Student Union Conference. It's an annual conference held at different universities across the East Coast. And every year it changes, and each year there's a different...
And one of the national board members who I became really good friends with was that it's not enough to just create a safe space on the internet anymore. It's important to also create a brave space. So you guys may know the phrase like safe space, brave space. And so these things go hand in hand because you have to be able to create a space for people to not only feel comfortable in embracing other people's opinions, but also create a space where they feel safe enough and also brave enough to voice their own. Because it's important for people to not just be in the audience and kind of like listen in and take in those things like kind of like a sponge. It's also important for them to, sorry, I have a cough drop in my mouth. It's also important for them to kind of like release that and also voice their own opinions, and in that it grows their own, it helps them better self-identify with whatever the issue is or whatever stance that they feel most comfortable and most most brave in taking as well. So I think it's really important in this internet age to create both of those kinds of spaces hand in hand.
We're actually at time, but I just wanted to ask if there was any particular person in the audience for a brief Q&A. We could certainly entertain that. Was there anyone in the audience that had a question?
Thank you for the panel. I'm so glad you put an emphasis on the media, the power of media. And as a human rights commissioner, I expect every Asian community supposed to be human rights commissioner. Because there's a Chinese woman and commit suicide from Confucius blood in Chinatown. And then police department just concluding the woman as a suicide in 2 days. And then the media question how come there's no question, maybe suicide or homicide. And then we just co-chair start police brutality and community relations. Actually, we indicted the police brutality. Finally, my name was highlighted on the newspaper. I was shocked. I was very scared. Oh, it's a big name. Then I realized the media, the power of the media. Yes, I'm going to make several examples to emphasize the media, the impact. First, James Hong, your co-director. I remember the director original, Hong Chung Huang, and she started first the 100,000 march in Washington, D.C. I'm really very, very, she's very instrumental to conceptualize the immigrant, the concept of immigrant. Usually the media always downsize immigrants. And then once I saw the Texas report, and I'm very surprised, Texas glorified the contribution of the media, the billion dollars contribution. Okay, number one, mobilizing. Number two, the transforming. In Chinatown, I'm always very worried. I feel guilty. I feel very bad. Chinatown, there's so many groups. All they work on themselves. There's a small pie. Everybody wants to grab the bigger part. So the lack of coordination, working together. I wonder, I challenge as a group, how could the media could mobilize, transform the community they are partying together and grabbing power together. Transform the field into a consensus. It's a very hard to build a consensus in China. The third, how to use media to achieve public education. Because especially the main call center, engaging the voter registration, they have very, very achieved a lot. So these three, I suggest you can answer, please.
The media is a good place where we can hear different opinions. So, I don't know, just like that the media could be a place where, it isn't so skewed, so that if the ethnic media, you know, can play the role of allowing those different voices or different opinions on any topic to surface. I think that would be helpful.
And part of that, just to also respond to Professor Ma, the issue also is what Anita had raised, is that part of transformation is that last part, the third part, which, right, if I may, is to talk about deconstruction and the treat through the deconstruction of the previously held biases and the negative self-regulation that one holds, and to break beyond that and to interact with the other or just understand how we are holding ourselves back is part of that self-education and education of the other and who they are, and removing those sort of false barriers, particularly the kinds that are actually set up by the current administration in Washington, D.C. right now.